You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
On behalf of Friends of Europe, I'd like to welcome you to our conversation, and I'm going to be introducing our very distinguished panel later. My name is Tamsin Rose, and I'm a senior fellow with Friends of Europe. Just a couple of points to let you know. You are welcome to tweet. You are welcome to listen and take the information. This is not Chatham House rules. The speakers will be speaking and sharing their views, representing their organisations. So just as a reminder, we're talking about the global health risks. If you had to list some of the top risks in the world that we're facing, climate change would obviously be one of them, but health risks would probably be up there very high on that list. It's certainly in the top 10 risks that the CIA lists every day, every year, as threats to America. It's listed by the World Economic Forum. So threats to individual health at a global level are enormous. And the only way we're going to be able to tackle them is by concerted global effort together. We're going to discuss a little bit in this panel how we deliver impact on this. We're going to explore what we mean by health risks and the extent to which the international community, let alone the European or national community, is ready to respond. But just to mention a few, the Ebola crisis, the European countries were heavily involved in the response. More recently, the Zika virus is a concern. We had a few cases in Europe. And as climate change changes the vectors of disease in Europe, we might expect to see more and more unexpected and unknown risks that we need to be prepared for. And that's when we're not thinking about the annual return every year of the flu, which each time has a high risk that it might become a pandemic. So global risks to health are very real. Just to introduce that Friends of Europe also has a debating platform called Debate Europe, with over a million individual citizens who've been involved in exploring different issues. And we've had a conversation with the general public about this issue, and there are two quotes that I would like to highlight for you, which give you a sense of how people think. First one, we have John from the UK, who says, "With easy travel, a virus can be transmitted anywhere in the world within hours. Therefore, it's in the interests of the developed countries to help tackle threats in the developing world." So it's our self-interest to invest in developing the treatments and the medications, but also the protocols that would help everyone everywhere. And then we have another viewpoint, which says there are tensions between science and levels of believability. So here we have Jean-Pierre from France. "We mustn't take health for granted. In this time of mass media consumption and intellectual laziness, there is an ongoing battle between knowledge and a rejection of validated science. And the debate over vaccination is a prime example for that." And we're all in this room, I'm sure, have been glued to our news feeds for the last couple of weeks. We've had a recent election in the United States where the issue of science, the credibility of science, was at the heart of some of the debates. So I think this question is really quite important for us to think about. You know, how do we make sure that validated science wins this battle between rumor and conspiracy theory and science? This is extremely important for global health, where just as viruses zip around the world in hours through plane travel, inaccurate science zips around the world in seconds due to our borderless internet. So having said that, this is our plan. Just to give you a sense of the format, we have four speakers who will all make a brief introductory speech, and then there will be a debate with the audience. We'll start with two. There'll be a Q&A if you'd like to clarify some of the comments that they've made, and then we'll have the final two opening statements, and then it's over to you in the room. You are part of this conversation. Cafe Crossfire is also about you. So let me start by introducing our first two speakers. And I'm delighted, first of all, to introduce Marc Sprimmer, who I have known for a number of years. And I'm sure in this room he's very familiar to you, having been leading a national institute in the Netherlands, working on health, then doing a stint at the European Centre for Disease Control, so coordinating at EU-level response. And now you are, I'm sure you'll explain more, a global ambassador for the WHO on the issue of AMR, antimicrobial resistance, which, if we don't do something about, is really possibly the end of medicine. And I don't think I'm overstating the case here. So it's an area where the WHO is really mobilising for action. So, Mark, if I could invite you to give us our first statement about this issue of how do we respond to global health risks and threats, because there is no such thing as a local health service anymore. We are facing risks that affect us all.
Thank you very much. I think you are right, but I also think that we underestimate the impact of not having effective antibiotics. Because now a lot of people do have flu, and maybe you will have pneumonia, and it's, you know, it's really bad if antibiotics don't work. But what we don't realize is that, for example, if you have a cancer therapy and your immune system is blocked, that if you don't have effective antibiotics, you will survive cancer, but you will die because of infections. And this is very sad. And in fact, modern medicine is really dependent on effective antibiotics. So that's one thing. Now, we have discussed antibiotic resistance over 20 years in, let's say, the medical circles, and I was one of them discussing that. Now, in fact, if I look back, it didn't help that much. But 21st of September, there was a historic event in my view. It was the high-level meeting of the UN General Assembly. It was the first week heads of states were there, and they have spent a whole day on AMR. Why is that important? Because the cause of resistance is overuse, is not having new antibiotics, not paying attention to healthcare systems. Now, the overuse is in human medicine, it's in agriculture. In agriculture, there is a lot of use of antibiotics, and a lot of people are not aware of that, but this is really an issue. There is pollution in the environment of antibiotic waste products. So the only way to really, you know, start to attack this problem is in a multi-sectoral approach. And that was why this meeting at that level was so important. And I have seen a lot of commitments, pledges of governments. And of course I understand that, okay, but you know, it's only paperwork. But it starts at a political level. If there is no political commitment to really fight against AMR, it will never work. And I have several examples of that. So it's very good that there is political attention and that things are moving. We cannot ask for miracles, but I'm sure that it is much higher on the agenda. Much more attention for drug development, for thinking about new business models. And today, WHO has released new guidelines of the core components for infection prevention control. IPC, infection prevention control, is a cornerstone of the fight against resistance. And sometimes it's very simple. It's just about behavior, washing your hands, paying attention to procedures in a hospital. And if we do that, resistance will be reduced in hospitals. Now, one of the alarming things is that there are a few drugs in the pipeline. But the drugs in the pipeline are not against really the nasty so-called gram-negative bugs. So we are really fearing that we don't have good antibiotics in the near future. And we know already that the last line antibiotics don't work anymore. And we are using, some of you know that, colistin, which is a toxic old-fashioned antibiotic. And even there, in parts of Europe, we are not talking about developing world, about Europe, the resistance is about 40%. Is that enough for kind of appetizer?
I think you, if anyone was still eating, I think they were, their mouths would have dropped open with what you just said there. I think that's a great opening statement, and you certainly explained to us the stakes, why the stakes are so high. It's exciting to hear that at heads of state level, they've really decided to take this seriously. Let me now pass the floor to John Ryan from the European Commission. You are the Director for Public Health, and congratulations on being confirmed. And you also have in your title crisis management. I think what Mark described pretty much describes the crisis management. But there's also this issue that you have an immediate crisis like Zika, and then you have a slow crisis like the antibiotic resistance issue. In your remit, working at European level, how well do you think the Member States and the Commission are working together to respond to both the immediate urgency and the longer-term high priorities?
So thank you, Tamsin, and thank you for the invitation. I'd like to maybe just start off by setting the scene before answering your question. First of all, to let you know that we have quite a tight legal system in place at European Union level on cross-border health threats. And this is composed of several components, six main components, in fact, one which deals with preparedness. So in other words, the member states have undertaken to prepare themselves for serious cross-border health threats and to report. And we in the Commission then can evaluate the level of preparedness and help those member states which are less prepared than others. Of course, preparedness is the foundation stone, I would say, of any system in this area. And we find that, of course, is very vulnerable in times when there are economic cuts, that the preparedness side is always the one which suffers the first. The second area, which is extremely important as well, is the area of surveillance, where we have a list of about 50 diseases and conditions at European Union level, where information is regularly collected through an electronic system by the ECDC in Stockholm, and therefore we know what the trends are annually for different diseases. The third component is related to an alert system, which we've introduced at European Union level, which is linked to the WHO system, which is a confidential system because it contains personal data, for example, on travellers and individuals. And this allows the member states to notify each other of outbreaks of communicable diseases if somebody is travelling or if there's an outbreak in a member state. On the basis of these alerts and on the basis of the surveillance, we have the possibility to ask the ECDC to prepare risk assessments. So this is a structured procedure where the ECDC actually analyzes the situation with the member states and then comes up with an analysis of the risk for the European Union. And the risk could come from outside the European Union, but it's principally looking at the European Union population. And the next stage of the procedure is to have a risk management process where in the Health Security Committee, the member states come together and discuss the risk. You were talking about Zika. We have weekly meetings now on the Zika outbreak. During the Ebola outbreak, we had over 60 meetings, I think, of the Health Security Committee, almost on a daily basis, discussing the Ebola outbreak. And the last part of the puzzle is in relation to medical countermeasures, because it was discovered during the pandemic, the flu pandemic, that many member states had difficulties in procuring medical countermeasures. Therefore, we've established a system for joint procurement of medical countermeasures, which allows the member states together to purchase medical countermeasures against communicable diseases. The next thing I'd like to mention, of course, is that this is only one part of the scheme, because, of course, you have the animal health legislation, which is much stronger, in fact. It's a bit of a paradox at European Union level because of the way the treaty is written. Animals are very often protected to a higher degree than humans. So therefore, the animal legislation at European Union level is very developed, as is the food safety legislation. And these are also relevant for cross-border health threats. And, of course, the pharmaceutical legislation, which is very strong at European Union level. So all of these aspects are very significant, I think, in allowing us to respond and to prepare for cross-border health threats. If you look then at the international stage, at how this links with the international system. We have the international health regulations, which are a binding international treaty managed by the WHO, and which our legislation is sort of the mirror image for the internal 28 member states. The IHR is the international system. And one of the big problems there is that the IHR has not actually been implemented. It's not been implemented by countries outside Europe, but also our own member states have difficulty with some of the core competences. And I must just finish up by mentioning that there are a lot of other community policies which are relevant, such as civil protection, the civil protection mechanism, such as the European Medical Corps, which has recently been created, such as the research program, which investigates new treatments, such as for Zika, but also for AMR, antimicrobial resistance, developing new antibiotics. I would also mention in the development aid programs, where we try and invest in strengthening health systems in developing countries. So you can see it's quite a complex environment. And I would say it's not only limited to human health, but you should also bring into the picture animal health, food safety, and development aid, and a lot of other things.
Excellent. Of course, health exists in a global framework of trade and movement of people and goods and animals and other issues. We now have a few minutes where I can invite the audience, if you have a clarification point you'd like to ask to our first speakers, because they've given us the policy and political framework that global health exists in. And the panel that follows is going to talk more about the science, the innovation and the R&D. So on this issue of the frameworks, the agreements between countries, the regulations, the things that underpin the global response, does anyone have a question they'd like to pose? Yes, we have a question there. And I'm sure, John, we're going to want to hear a little bit more about this European Medical Corps, because I'm not quite sure if that's, as my son would love, it would be an ambulance with a siren that goes nina nina, but I'm sure it's more complicated than that. Yeah. Fraser.
Yeah, hello, my name's Fraser Goodwin. I work with Save the Children's EU office here in Brussels. Neither of you actually elaborated the role of the Sustainable Development Goals framework and the important role that universal health coverage as part of Goal 3 will give to increasing health security globally. And bearing in mind, next week we'll see the Agenda 2030 EU roadmap published. I'd like to hear what your ideas as to how we can better support universal health coverage globally as a response, so that we don't see a future health crisis because of strengthened health systems globally.
Excellent, thank you. That's definitely going to fall to John, and Mark, you might also want to comment about the SDGs, but John.
Well, actually, I have the proof here. It's written on my piece of paper, but Tamsin was giving me the eye, so I decided to stop. But sustainable development goals are, I think, very important in setting objectives and setting guidelines for international cooperation and for helping us to target international support. I'm not convinced myself that the indicators which have been developed are necessarily sufficiently fine-tuned to enable us to measure progress. But I mean, there have been examples. I'm thinking here of HIV treatment in sub-Saharan Africa, where you have set international targets and you have actually achieved them. So I think there's a lot to be said for setting targets, but the resources then need to follow, and you need to be able to measure progress, I think. So I think it's only part of the solution. Even at the European Union level, I think there is an element of concern about these sustainable development goals, because there's a question as to how they apply within the European Union as well as to the developing world. So this is also a political issue which is being discussed. We are openly supporting the idea that WHO targets should also be included in our thinking. So we're not trying to fix WHO targets or fix targets for elimination of diseases at the European Union level. The WHO is there to do that, for example, on polio, on vaccination for measles, on a whole series of issues. And I think we can take inspiration from the WHO in addition to these sustainable development goals to try and incorporate that in our thinking.
Mark, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, I can reassure you cannot enter the WHO buildings in Geneva without bumping into the big banners of the SDGs. So this is for us very important. It relates also to maternity health, childhood health care, all these things. So that's why we have a lot of cross-links within headquarters about these topics. But in particular, universal health care is important, and health systems. Because if we have one day a new miracle antibiotic, but if there is no pharmaceutical chain, there is no pharmacy. And in a lot of countries, this is not regulated. There is no training for pharmacists. There is no quality control. It does not work. And we know, in particular for antibiotics, that I think more than 50% of the antibiotics are counterfeit, are substandard quality. So this is extremely important that we pay attention to all these aspects. And of course, as WHO, we always advocate you should not have antibiotic without prescription. But that means that you need to have access to healthcare. And a lot of people in other countries don't have access to a GP.
Thank you again for highlighting the fact that, you know, science and scientific innovation happens in a broader framework. We need to be able to have cold chains for vaccines. We need pharmacies. We need access to GPs. We have need systems that allow you to have a prescription. So this is, you're right, and I'm sure our next speakers will talk about how the work they do fits is needs to operate in an environment. But John, can I just ask you to mention the European Medical Corps, because you said it's a recent innovation, and the audience may not know what it actually is. Is it ambulances ready to go?
No, it's not. The idea of the European Medical Corps, it's really a system which draws on national resources and brings in financing from the European Union level in order to mobilise an on-call team which can be brought in emergency situations. Speaking here under the watchful eye of its founder. But this largely came up from the Ebola outbreak, I think, and from similar outbreaks where we really needed to identify very quickly competences around Europe which could be mobilised. One of the issues which we have in Europe is the mandate of the ECDC. The mandate of the ECDC is limited to the European Union. So therefore, it's difficult to take staff from the ECD and just send them off to Haiti or to West Africa. We have done that, but on a very limited scale, because the legal mandate of the ECDC is limited to the member states. So in that sense, it's very different from the US CDC, which, if I remember correctly, has 18,000 staff, and compared to the 300 staff in the ECDC. So really what I think the Medical Corps idea is to try and identify competences at national level, and to a number of member states have now identified staff who are available to move and to be part of this team in case they need to be mobilised.
Okay, thank you. So that's a really very practical and concrete example of how the policy underpinnings are enabling science and innovation to come together and to operate effectively internationally wherever they're needed, which I think is a nice bridge to the next conversation that we're going to have with two people who operate in that space of science and innovation. And I'm delighted to pass the floor to Nancy Lee, who is a senior policy advisor at the Wellcome Trust, which I understand is one of the world's largest global charitable trusts working on health. Nancy.
Great. Thanks very much, Tamsin. So a bit of background for you, for those who don't know the Wellcome Trust. We are a global independent foundation. We spend around 900 million euros per annum on funding science to improve health. So from basic science, such as the Human Genome Project, through to translation, like funding the clinical trials for the VSV vaccine for Ebola, through to public engagement, ethics and humanities, all with the aim of improving health for global citizens. So turning to our question today, why is this important to us? It's really important that we optimise the science, which we see as a global public good, to the benefit of us in Europe and across the world. And I guess in this time of post-Brexit, post-truth, post-Trump, the opportunity is here for us in Europe to really pull together and see how we can optimise and mobilise our resources, our expertise, to address a common goal. And Europe is very well placed to do this. So with the strength of our intellectual knowledge, our industry, the institutions that we have, the frameworks that we have, this is where we can really make a difference. the importance of R&D cannot be overstated. So not only for the need of new products, so new diagnostics, new antibiotics, new therapies and emergencies, but really understanding how in an outbreak we, through public health measures, can interrupt these quickly. And that is really working through communities. So I reiterate the statement about building health systems. That needs to happen in communities. We need to engage and we need to support those in communities most vulnerable to do that. So, for example, we know in Ebola, the fall-off of cases happened when we were able to have local communities engage in changing practices which happen, which has happened for millennia in those communities. And again, that requires us to help build expertise in country. And this requires country governments and communities to buy in. So, from a welcome perspective, we would like to see it happening in country. We support researchers who work in country. It's important to translate the basic research that we fund, both here in Europe and globally, so that communities can take that to their policymakers. We're at a stage now where our resources are limited. So what's important is, and I think we'll turn to this anyway, so we refer to a global health security agenda. There's questions around the word security, but what speaks most to governments? What makes finance ministers and heads of state really stand up and take notice? And unfortunately, it's the word security. But what do we need to ensure that we have countries that have budget lines from their finance ministers to deal with health? And that is providing them with the evidence and providing communities with the evidence to show that this will really make a difference to them. And that's across both the slow-moving emerging threats like AMR, so working with the WHO to show, to take mapping of the impact of AMR on communities. So there's work that we fund and support, I guess, again, with WHO, mapping the impact of a resistance, so that the countries can then at least explain what that means to them and how they can develop their individual national programs to address those. In the development space, I think we need to think collectively around new models for financing and new models for working collectively. So in the vaccine space specifically, a new initiative called CEPI, Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, is doing that. It's a multi-sector initiative which is looking to work across industry, regulators, the public sector to develop vaccines for pathogens of epidemic potential just in time and just in case, so they're ready to go before an outbreak occurs. So I just think I could close with a few statements around. It'd be great to discuss how we can work more collectively across European institutions to really focus the tools that we have. We already know we've got programs like GLOPIDAR, IMI, JPIMR. How can we maximise the resource that we're spending on these to target outcomes for impacts for people in countries of need?
Excellent. Thank you for that. There was quite a lot of alphabet soup at the end of that. I'm not sure how much this audience fully understands some of them, and maybe we'll pick them up and we'll have a chance to explain some of them because they might be a little confusing. But let me now turn to someone who perhaps spends more of his time with a lab coat on, which is rare in these policy circles. So Michael Murias from Sanofi, you're the cluster head for bacterial infections. You're probably the one who can foresee the most of what's coming for us in terms of, as we heard, nasty bugs. And also you will have a sense of how fast science can develop responses. And we're certainly hoping that there will be some new responses. So what can you tell us about the kind of work that's happening in R&D and innovation, what we can expect, and then also how that fits in the broader picture of being able to respond?
Yes, well, that's quite a presentation you're making and making me responsible for a huge task.
You're the scientist. We have lots of hopes for you.
Exactly. As a preamble, I'd like just to say that as a pharma representative, first of all, in Sanofi, I'm only one face of the people who are tackling AMR from the science side. Secondly, as pharma representative, of course, pharma are committed to the improvement of global human health. That's for sure. But in the case of AMR, make no mistake, we see this as a risk, not an opportunity. Because as Mark Sprenger was saying, what is the point of developing a new anti-cancer drug, that is a miracle drug, if your patient is going to die from infection? So this is a risk for us too, as pharma. And this is also on top of this agenda for this commitment to improve human health, this I think explains why we are so committed as pharma to this problem, and as could be seen in the Davos Declaration and recently along the 21st September meeting, high-level meeting, the roadmap that was published. But I'd like to focus on science. And my main goal is really to tell you that it's not because we feel there's no return on investment in that field that we are not showing anything for it. It's because it's tough. It's a very complicated problem. And I'd like to stop on two points, the clinical development issues and the preclinical issues. In terms of clinical development issues, if you want, people have to understand that if you want to address the nastiest bug affecting the gravest and sickest of patients, it's a very complicated challenge because not everybody is dying from this very nasty infection. You have to find these patients, and there is 10, 20% of those patients scattered all across Europe, and you have to find them quickly because when they are infected, they die quickly. If you do the clinical trials the usual way, which is to enroll a lot of patients, some of them will be quickly cured and some of them will not, very few of them will not be quickly cured. We need to enroll a lot and a lot of patients, lose a lot of time. And in the end, it will be very, very hard to show the efficacy of our drug because most of the patients respond to the control, to the traditional care. So it's a very complicated problem to access the patient quickly. So for that, we need the help of academics. We need the help of the health systems in order, for instance, to establish a clinical trial network. And we've seen things happening in that direction, both in Europe and in the US. We also need the health authorities to recognize that if we go for very limited patient populations, we need the health authorities to recognize that if we show something in these patient populations, we can have authorization to market these drugs for this population and for this population only, even if it has to be, and we are welcoming that, if it is only for these populations. So that's what I wanted to say on the clinical development side. On the more fundamental sides, I want to highlight a few problems. First one is, as Mark Spenger was saying, there are a few very nasty bugs. And the reason why they are nasty is not because they have no weakness, they have plenty of weaknesses, but there is plenty of targets in these bugs. But the problem is we cannot get the drug to those targets. There is a penetration issue. Our biggest threat is those gram-negative bacteria for which there is an envelope that prevents the effective drug to get in. So understanding the penetration is a big issue. Traditionally, the pharmas are using rules to design their molecules that are called the Lipinski rules. And we know for a fact that these Lipinski rules do not apply to make a good antibacterial because the antibacterials are all very different from the Lipinski obedient drugs. So that being said, we don't know what makes a good antibacterial. And we need to know because so far we've been lucky and we've found products, but we don't know why they get in. And for that, we tried by ourselves and we failed. Now we need the help of the community. That touches on the point of data sharing. We've tried a lot of things. And again, without getting at the heart of why the drugs get in. And it would be nice to be able to share our failures in order with the other pharmas and to explain, first of all, to the academic community what didn't work and also to maybe together gain insights. The other thing I would like to say is that we need new chemical matter. Traditionally, the antibiotics are coming from the microbial world. They are natural products. And we've mined these resources over and over again, and we are not identifying anything new. So with the rules at hand, maybe we can find, and looking at in other directions, maybe we can find new chemical matter. But this is a very tough problem, very difficult. Where to look? What to look for? And lastly, I would like to touch on the aspect of alternative to antibiotics. Like the science in the past decades has evolved a lot in the understanding on how a bacterium is causing an infection. And so opening up the avenues for tackling these peculiar virulence, for instance, aspect of the bacterium. But to be fair, there is no such drug on the market. So even if we had something like that, how would we use it? What to look for? How do we test that in preclinical models? Something that kills in a mouse, we know is going to kill in a human. but something that prevents the variance in a mouse, how do we know it's going to prevent the variance in a human? And even if it were, what do you look for in a patient who is already under therapy with an antibiotic that usually works pretty well? So these are huge area of issues for which we have no good answers, no good guidance. But rest assured, we are not deterred, and so we are committed to work in these directions. There is certainly a few incremental steps that Mark Sprenger was alluding to that. So in the pipelines, you can see there are drugs that are nearing the market, but they are all coming from existing classes. There are improvement of old stuff, and this is fine. This is great. We need that as a stopgap. But the pharmas are really committed to bring true innovation by really breaking the barrier of this penetration, new targets, new chemical matter, and alternative to antibiotics. But for that, we need, again, the community, the pharmas, working together, support of regulatory authorities and also of political authorities.
Okay. Thank you for that. Just to, before I open up to the floor, you mentioned the importance of data sharing, and you've highlighted for us some of the really tricky challenges in the sort of pure science area. What's preventing that data being shared? What's preventing those scientific breakthroughs from happening?
So there's a number of things. First of all, there is the impression that if we... So you have to understand what the data means. The data means is a collection of, let's say, thousands of molecules with their structures, their activity in a bacterium, their activity in a toxicity assay. And most of these molecules don't work, okay? So what would be interesting, for instance, would be to compare all the structures that work and don't work in order to find some rules, for instance, so that we could extrapolate rules that make a drug work and not work. But if we give, as a pharma company, if we give everything away like that, maybe somebody is going to look into it and says, oh, but that drug could be very interesting. And so we lose the intellectual property on that. So it's very difficult as a pharma company to give everything away without having to look at that carefully, molecule by molecule first, whether there is any chance that that molecule could one day become a real drug. We have plenty of failed old drugs. But we need to go molecule at molecule, and this is a very difficult endeavor. That's one thing. And second thing is we need also a very strong voice coming from partners saying, why do they want this? I only state in my opinion, but we need partners to say, why do they want this? How do they want to do it? What are the steps they can put in place to safeguard IP if we were to share beyond what we can share, losing IP?
Okay, I know, Mark, you wanted to come in on this, but I have to share an image with you that came up in my mind when you were talking. The sad loss of the pop star Prince, and he apparently has a vault where he has hundreds of albums that were never released of amazing music. Somebody's got to go through that and decide what he might have liked to release to us, what's of good enough quality. So when you talked about this huge database of stuff that you've got to go through before you release and decide where the potential jewels are, this, I can see, is a major task to do. Mark?
Yes, I would like to allude a little bit on one of your first issues. I went to Cape Town and had a discussion with Doctors Without Borders. And I asked them, what is the real problem for you? And TB is a huge problem in South Africa. In particular, multi-drug-resistant TB. Now, the good news is that I have developed new antibiotics against multi-drug TB. But the real problem there is, how do we discover that this is a multi-drug TB? Now, the usual methods took about 6 weeks. So I have developed a new machine. It's called the X-Gene, Gene Expert, sorry. And this is a kind of revolution. But then again, there were a lot of financial problems. How could that diagnostic test become accessible for people in also these countries? So there is a huge, let's say, policy thinking behind all these things to make that accessible. And today, only 20% of all the cases of multi-drug resistant TB are discovered. So the majority is not discovered and is still spreading the disease. So we need to pay attention to diagnostics as well.
Okay. Well, not just diagnostics, actually manufacturing capacity, because I assume if you've got a machine that will allow you to do this very fast gene testing, you then have to produce that machine and get it out there. So, as you say, there are hurdles in the science development stage, but then in both the production, manufacturing, and diagnostic areas. So lots of challenges for us to deal with in global health. Let me open up to the floor. We have 20 minutes where we can exchange with our four expert speakers. There's plenty that's been put on the table that I think we could open up and talk about more. Can I just see who would like... I see one hand here. Who else at this point would like to come in? We'll start here at the front. If you'd like to briefly introduce yourself and then pose your question.
Thank you very much. My name is Elizabeth Kuiper, speaking for FPIA, the research based pharmaceutical industry. I actually have a question to Mark Sprenger, because you spoke about the momentum that you really felt also in the context of the September UN meeting. And I see what you're speaking about, because we also, as an industry, as we just said, really also feel our responsibility in that respect. And that's also why, as a follow-up of this Davos declaration, we came up with the so-called September roadmap, with a contribution, a concrete contribution to tackle AMR, just to name two examples when it comes to further work on stewardship, but also further work on business models, because of the fact that we need other business models, not based on volume, but really based on responsible use, and indeed with a view to creating new drugs. And it interests me that actually all of you said that what's needed nowadays is more collaboration between the sectors, between the private sector and the public sector. And being almost at the end of 2016, I think after a year, and most probably 2 years, where we saw a lot of work with Lord O'Neill, who delivered his last report, and the UN meeting, et cetera, et cetera. My question would be, what's needed in order to make this all happen? Is it just that we should start implementing all the proposals that are at the table, or are other policy elements needed in order to make this a workable approach?
Okay, that's a good question. If the political will is now rolling, what are the things that we now need to move out of the way to allow this to happen? The science is very clear about the need to collaborate. Heads of state are on board. The scientific community, the charity, the development committee are all saying there's a need for it. Where are the roadblocks? What else do we need to do to move this forward?
In the outcome document of the high-level meeting, it is stated that there should be an inter-agency coordination mechanism, because they recognize that you can only solve this issue if a lot of UN organizations are connected, but not only UN organizations, also other organizations. So at this moment, they are discussing how to set up that coordinating mechanism. That's one thing. Now, what I have learned from all the discussions about what's called new business models is that this is really very difficult. It's very complicated. There is a big EU initiative. It's a Drive AB project. I went to meetings and I was really impressed by, in fact, complexity. I know this is on the agenda of the G7 and G20. I know that Germany is making this one of their priorities in the G20 meeting. And I think these political commitments are important to get that, let's say, higher on the agenda. And of course, I can understand what are now the concrete results. But I'm sure that in future there will be results. And I see already funds that are available for drug development.
Maybe at this point, Nancy, I might like to invite you to decode for us some of that alphabet soup, because I think the new business models and the need for collaboration are maybe answered through things like the DNDi and others. Can you tell us some of the examples that you can see that really show the first movements towards this collaboration?
Yeah, so the ones that I mentioned, so IMI, which is the Innovative Medicines Initiative, JPIMR, which is a joint, partnership on AMR across Europe.
Yes.
So that's medical research councils getting together to collaborate on spending for AMR. So these are very much at the basic end of research, and it then goes through the pipeline, and then we need to address what effectively the market failure question and the pull mechanisms. So I think groups like FPIA and umbrella groups are very much at the heart of how we find consensus amongst industry groups as much as possible as to what are the appropriate mechanisms. So we know the O'Neill O'Neill review suggested pay or play. There are other mechanisms out there. I think the OECD has been tasked with considering what other economic models might be appropriate. Drive AB have also been considering this. So there is certainly momentum there, and I think I know that individual pharma companies have got their ideas as well. So we as a community, I think, need to continue to push this. There are questions as to who covers the cost, but again, going back to science as a global good and health as a global good, we really need to consider, given the threat, how we address it. And at the end of the day, I think we all need to contribute to it because it's going to affect all of us. But I think groups like FPIR and others really have a pivotal role to play in keeping the players on target.
Excellent. John, I think I'm going to come to you because Mark mentioned things that it's on G7, it's on G20, we've had the UN high-level summit. So it sounds like things are percolating through at a political level. You've worked at European level for a number of years now, and you've talked about, in your opening statement, about the fact that there's been developments despite the limited treaty on things like potential joint procurement. The urgency has been a driver to create new mechanisms. What can you tell us maybe about the political will at European level to do some of this cross-sectoral collaboration and go outside people's silos?
I think the antimicrobial resistance file is one of the most complicated files there is on the table. In response to the question that was asked about the development of new antibiotics and how you develop a new business model, I think I remember discussing this with Professor Otto Kahrs during a Swedish presidency many, many years ago, and it seems to me that the solution has not been found. I have an economic background myself, so I'm very interested in this subject, but it's clearly a very complicated issue that you're proposing to the industry to research and develop new products, and then the instruction that would be given to doctors is not to prescribe those products or to prescribe them very sparingly. So from a business point of view, just to put it very simply, it doesn't add up. It's like manufacturing a new car and then telling people they shouldn't drive it, you know, they should take their bike. So that's a little bit the problem. It's a much more complex issue, but I'm just trying to express it simply. But I think there's no point in solving the business model unless you solve at the same time the stewardship part, because it seems to me that both are very closely linked. And the stewardship part, and nobody has mentioned it so far, is also a problem of animal health. Because in many parts of the world, antibiotics are still used as growth promoters. Not the case in the European Union, we hope. But in many parts of the world, it's the case. And there's this transfer between the animal world and the human environment. So I think it's important for us in the European Union level, and I think this is the vision we have, to try and get our act together in terms of legislation on the pharmaceutical side, on the animal health side, on the food safety side, try and put in place mechanisms to limit the use of antibiotics to those cases where it's necessary for human health and animal health. And we have a proposal for a European legislation which is in the Council and the Parliament at the moment. It was just discussed just yesterday in the Agri Council. And where there is some reluctance by member states to actually adopt the proposal to tighten the rules for the use of antibiotics in veterinary medicine. So, and even on the human side, there are questions about how you harmonize the situation regarding the use of antibiotics in human medicine, which varies between the member states. Yeah. We don't have a single legislative system for the use of antibiotics in human medicine. I had a meeting yesterday afternoon with the Swedish Minister of Health, and I don't think I'll give away any secrets to say that Sweden is one of the better organized member states in terms of antimicrobial stewardship. The minister was complaining to us that there are increasing problems of seizures of antibiotics coming in through the postal system into Sweden with no prescriptions. So it seems that even in a country as well organized as Sweden and as advanced in terms of awareness of the problem, that there are still ways that people are getting around the prescription system. So I think it's a vast issue. What I would say is, in agreement with what Mark said, that the fact that politicians have actually grabbed this issue now and have recognized that it is a problem has been very helpful in the sense that there will be resources which will flow. When these issues are identified as priorities, it follows that there will be attention given on the legislative side, but also on the funding side. What I'm afraid of is that we still have a long way to go in terms of hospital-acquired infections, in terms of surveillance, in terms of animal health, even in Europe, letting aside the rest of the world. So there's a huge, it's really a very complicated file, and I think we have to do everything we can until new products appear to do what we can to prevent and to improve stewardship.
Thank you. I'm just going to open again to the room. I know we have one question at the back. Does anyone else want to add in? Lady at the back. There we are. Thank you. And what we might pick up on is what you finally mentioned there, this issue of public culture, the extent to which it isn't just the stewardship of the systems, but it's also about individual behaviour that needs to change and address health risks. Yes.
Hi, thank you. Nina Renshaw from the European Public Health Alliance. I wanted to ask about a specific case. Just over a year ago, there was a nightclub fire in Bucharest, and as a result of that fire, more than 60 people died. But up to a quarter of them actually died of hospital-acquired infections, which were drug-resistant or multi-drug-resistant. So I wanted to know, for the Health Security Committee, but also for the institutions and organisations you represent, what lessons were learned from that about how the EU responds? Because many of those patients were transferred to specialist care in hospitals in other countries and taking those drug-resistant infections with them.
Oh, that's a tough one. Who would like to pick up on that? But a very concrete example, thank you for that, to say, look, this is not just about people coming in on airplanes from other parts of the world. These are actually also about gaps that we have in our own health systems. And it seems perfectly logical that we would move patients to where they can receive the urgent specialist care that they need. But they come with all of the potential infection risk that they bring. Does anyone want to comment on that example? John?
Well, this particular case is one of many cases that you happen to know about this case, but there's another case going on at the moment, an international alert originating in the same member state involving multi-drug resistant TB. I would say in the first case, we focused on facilitating the movement of patients because healthcare facilities in the member state in question were overwhelmed by the number of burns patients. And therefore, we did help in the Health Security Committee to move people around. But in that sort of circumstance, you are really dependent on the screening systems that are in place in the receiving hospitals. And that's why we have a council recommendation from 2009 aimed at setting in place systems for surveillance of hospital-acquired infections. And member states are supposed to put in place surveillance of hospital-acquired infections, including AMR. And in most cases, they are in place, but whether they operate up to speed is another question. But in principle, the member states do have systems in place to screen incoming patients, particularly those coming from outside the member state in question. Mm-hmm. There's a very good example, I suppose, in Holland, where they have really been a best practice example of how to stop infections coming in from outside the hospital and trying to reduce spread of hospital infections. And they even have their own internal systems in Netherlands, which Mark told me about some years ago, which actually involve disciplinary proceedings against the hospital managers if it doesn't happen. So I think there's a lot which could be learned from good practice in other member states.
So high levels of accountability built into that system to deliver. Does anyone else on the panel want to comment on that?
Just read The Lancet. Last week we published procedures for surgical side infections, and I think today it was published, our guidelines. And these are the core components of a IPC system that in each hospital should be in place. But the reality is, you know, we are far from that. Mm-hmm. And again, it's also a question about accountability. If no one feels accountable, if it's only an infection prevention nurse who feels accountable, it will not work. This is an issue where the CEO of a hospital should be accountable.
Okay. And I think this is an issue that would be worth exploring further in future meetings. I mean, we had a terrorist attack here in March. There have been attacks in other countries. And when you have disaster medicine, patients get moved where they need to go. And so I can foresee that in the future we may also have to make sure that as part of the protocols for transfer, we've got very strong protocols on checking for and managing infections, because those would go with those patients. And my son was transferred from one hospital in the UK to here, in between the NICU departments. And they tested him for MRSA in the UK. And when he arrived here, they tested him. All the time he was in the hospital here, every 2 days, they were testing him. And I assume that's in case other patients that were coming in or other healthcare workers might infect. So I know that in some countries they're being very careful on this. And, of course, the fact that we transferred from the UK was a very clear risk factor for them, because the UK has an issue with MRSA. But I want to thank all of our panelists for highlighting some issues for us. And I'm sure the issue of emergency medicine and emergency preparedness is not going to go away. I have to say, John, you must suffer insomnia from the number of alerts you see. If we were shocked with what we heard there about that one case and you said, ha, that's what you know about, I imagine that you see, I'm surprised that your hair isn't white completely after the things that you see. Thank you very much to our panel for sharing this with us. The issue of health risk is something that affects us all. And as we ended on the note of accountability, it can't just be down to the individual nurse or even the individual patient. It's something that society needs to take on board. Nancy, you told us, you know, science is a public good and healthcare is a public good. We need to all mobilise to respond to that, to protect it and make sure it's adequately resourced. Thank you to Michael for all the work you do in the lab. We need it. We hope you do more, and we're looking for more breakthroughs. So thank you all to our panel. I hope you go away pleased that there's some change happening at the global level, that the UN's tackling it, it's on the G7, the G20. Hopefully this will shift the political resources, because, Mark, you said that when there's cuts, and let's face it, we're all in a time of cuts to our healthcare systems, the first thing that goes is infection preparedness. And I hope that this political attention to it means that it won't be the obvious cut anymore, that there will be more attention paid to making sure we're ready for things just in time, just in case. Thank you all. Enjoy the rest of your day. I hope you don't get rained on as you did this morning. Thank you.